This week's travels take us out to the Sturt National Park, where ecologists, national park rangers and volunteers are all getting ready to reintroduce native species to the area. A former Tassie dairy farmer makes the switch from cows to chooks. He says he feels like a mother hen to his free-ranging girls. A disability support service in Victoria embarks on a mushroom-led recovery for their workers. And you're going to meet raw honey producers Doug and Janine Cannon. Beekeeping was an odd choice for this young couple when they were considering what to do with their small rural block.
We decided on lychees and I was ready to sort of put an order in to start off with 250 trees. And right at the last minute, Janine said, "I don't want to do lychees." And I said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And she says, "Oh, well, what about bees?" Which she has severe reactions to bees, yeah. So I was surprised that she went with bees.
Surprising indeed. Honey mushrooms and free-ranging pastured chooks all ahead. But let's begin in outback New South Wales, where the ground is being prepared for some very special arrivals.
So we just put a little tube in there so that we've got something that animals can hide in. And we do have a little stink in here. So this is a little Ternotus schomburgkii. So we can tell that because they have this beautiful pattern here with the orange squares. They're probably our most common skink.
Wildlife ecologist Rebecca West is holding a small skink in her hands. If she's lucky, it'll be just one of many native species she and the rest of the team will trap in the next few days as part of the Wild Deserts project.
From the snout to the vent and then also the tail length because in certain
Hello, I'm Amy Volkovsky. We're in Sturt National Park in the far northwest corner of New South Wales. Rebecca and the team are preparing two sites to reintroduce some native species into this area, some which haven't been seen in the region for the past 200 years.
While we're here now, we can just let him go again. We've taken all the measurements that we need.
Construction has started on two 20-square-kilometre secure enclosures where the animals will be released, safe from foxes, wild dogs and feral cats. But before that can occur, ecologists, national park rangers and volunteers need to find out what already exists here, developing a baseline record of the plants, animals and invertebrates that can be used for comparison purposes. Rhys Pedler is the project coordinator.
We're in the far northwestern corner of New South Wales in Sturt National Park, and we're probably just here about 20 kilometres from the very corner of the state at Cameron Corner. And we're in the project area for the Wild Deserts project, which aims to restore quite a large area of Sturt National Park and reintroduce some locally extinct mammal species.
In all, seven species will be reintroduced into the enclosures, including mulgaras, which are related to Tasmanian devils. Also, bilbies, burrowing bitongs, bandicoots, stick nest rats and quolls.
This is day three of trapping. What are you sort of looking at so far in terms of what you're seeing and what that's telling you about this area?
We're running a trapping program every year, and what we're trying to look at is what species are here at the moment so that we can then track how that changes when we build the enclosures that are going to remove feral species from the area, so we'll eradicate them from those areas, and then we expect to see some really significant changes in the ecosystem. So lots of plants will grow back that aren't here at the moment because they're grazed by rabbits or lots of kangaroos, and lots of species that are really susceptible to cat and fox predation are likely to come back again. So we've, this week we've had a reasonable number of captures, actually less than we had in October last year, which was the last time we did the trapping. And I think that's because of a very long and hot, dry summer, which a lot of people will have experienced. So we would expect those numbers to drop. But we did actually open some sites this year across the border in South Australia, where there's a different sort of assemblage of animals over there. So you tend to get fewer kangaroos and fewer cats and foxes because of the presence of dingoes, because that's the other side of the dog fence. And it's been interesting to compare the captures either side. So yeah, we've caught mammals on that side of the fence, which would suggest that they're struggling here because of the presence of those animals.
Copy that, Beck or Catherine?
Yeah, got you there, Reese.
Okay, we've just come in from the north. We've actually got a little hopping mouse with us if you want to have a look at that with ABC.
Yep, sounds good.
We'll meet him at the Kiwi Hut.
We'll meet you at the Kiwi Hut. We've got them with us at the minute.
There's work being done, there's fences being built. When do you expect the first introduction, which is, I think, bilbies, isn't it?
Yep, so we're hoping to release the greater bilby first, and if everything goes to plan, that would happen next year, probably late autumn, just before early winter. So, yeah, we're hoping we're going to be able to go ahead as planned, but we've got to get a fence up first and make sure we've eradicated everything we need to.
Part of the original setup of this is building the fence. We're sitting actually next to a big pile of stuff to build it, and we've been driving along tracks that have been cleared to build those. When will the fence be up? When do you expect that?
Yeah, so we've just had the delivery of nearly all of our netting. So we're going to build initially about 40 kilometres of netting fence, and just last week completed the clearing those fence lines ready for that to happen. So we expect to get one underway pretty shortly. The fence design is a unique design for feral exclusion. It's about 6 feet, 180 centimetres high, and has a floppy sort of overhang. So those two features, the foot netting at the bottom to stop digging predators and the small netting to stop rabbits are critical, and also this floppy overhang at the top so cats and foxes climb up and they just can't navigate this overhang. A lot of work goes into building it.
How many k's of fencing will be up in the end?
40 kilometres initially, and then in the second stage we hope to link up another 10 kilometres of fence, which will link to the Queensland border and also to the New South Wales border. So within our little diamond shaped exclosures we hope to have zero cats, rabbits, foxes or dingoes, and reintroduce seven locally extinct mammal species. In the larger area we have a really unique opportunity to build on some work that's been done in other places by our team, and have low numbers of cats, and to give these animals that are living in a predator-proof exclosure some exposure to feral predators. The theory and the work that's gone in is recognising that although there's lots of work going into ways to control cats and foxes across the mainland, we'll never be able to get rid of them completely. And so trying to work on the native prey species and trying to get them a bit more savvy to what these feral predators are, and hopefully get some smarts so that they can one day live outside these fenced exclosures on the mainland. Yeah, they can learn those skills and perhaps pass them on to their offspring.
So this is Larista labialis. So these ones are relatively common. The other Larista that we get out here is Larista xanthura, which is actually a threatened species in New South Wales. It's called the yellow-tail plain slider, so they have a much darker body and this really yellow tail, and we've caught two of those so far this week. So they'll be a sort of species that once you remove feral animals and let the vegetation grow, they're likely to do quite well. So we should see an increasing xanthura.
A bit like their mother hen a bit. They see me from day one and I'm with them every day. And they used to me providing their feed too, I suppose. And yeah.
Meet Phil Glover. This former dairy farmer has turned his pastures over to the birds. From small beginnings just 5 years ago, he and his wife Angela now have almost 3,500 Highline brown hens, free-ranging across these paddocks. Right now, a flock of them is cruising around our legs, even pecking at my shoes.
Yeah, they're pretty curious things. They like to be up with what's going on. Anything that's different attracts their attention.
Hello, I'm Margot Kelly. The Glovers are based near Sheffield in northwest Tasmania. They got into producing free-range pastured eggs after getting out of the dairy industry. They've swapped one 52 weeks of the year job for another.
Our farm got too small to be viable to milk cows anymore, so we sold the cows and just went into beef, and then we brought a shop, was in that for a few years, and we sold that and was looking around for another business and couldn't find anything that took our interest. And then we bought 300 Highline Brown pullets, point of lay, and thought we'd give the egg thing a bit of a go. And it's just gone from there. Like, the demand's been incredible. It's just gone from strength to strength.
The chickens are housed in mobile sheds, which can be easily moved around the paddocks, giving the chickens access to fresh pasture. Phil Glover says his girls love to get outside and scratch around in the grass.
They really love the fresh grass. Like, we move our chooks around pretty regular. We probably varies from 4 to 6 weeks. They'll go into a fresh paddock, and as soon as you put them into a fresh paddock, they just sort of really get really excited and they go around and eat heaps of grass. They're concentrated food, you notice that they don't eat as much for probably a week or a fortnight. They seem to prefer to get a lot of their fresh food. They really go for the grass and bugs and stuff.
When not out foraging for the good stuff, the hens can be found inside their sleeping and laying quarters. Can we check out the inside? So what's the setup here? These are the sleeping quarters.
Yeah, these sheds, these are where the chooks sleep, eat and lay their eggs and get their water. Each shed holds 250 birds, which works out to be 10 birds to the square metre. They're being built, we build them all ourselves, we design them ourselves, and everything in them we build ourselves. They're like really low tech, simple, easy to maintain, yeah.
What's the production rate of a hen? Is it an egg a day?
Oh, it wouldn't be quite an egg a day. Ours peak at 90, in the 90%, you know, about 92, 95, 96%. They probably average in our system about 80%, yeah.
And how do you collect that many eggs?
It's all done by hand, the old-fashioned way. We just come down with a box on the back of it to protect the eggs. We've got plastic egg collecting trays. You walk in the shed, pick up any eggs off the floor, and then we just go along the nest. The nest's a rollaway nest, and we just put the eggs into trays, stack the trays up, and then put them on the ute, and then drive to the next shed. And yeah, continue on like that till we've got right around the whole farm. It's probably the opposite of what most big chook farms are. We're very, I suppose, we just do everything the old-fashioned way. Anything we can do, you know, the whole operation, something doesn't work, we can fix it ourselves.
Once the eggs have been collected, it's time to head indoors, into the packing shed, where the eggs are weighed and sorted before being dispatched around the northwest. So this is where the stainless steel is at?
Yeah, this is our grading and packing room. This is where the eggs come to after we collect them. They're brought into here and daily and graded into weights and packed into cartons. They stay in here, stored in here in our refrigerated container until we're ready to sell them. We sell a variety of sizes. We have 500 gram dozens, 600 gram dozens, 700 gram dozens, 800 gram dozens, and then we have jumbos, which are like oversized eggs that your cartons won't close on. Yeah.
Oh, I can see a few here. Yeah, they're pretty big ones.
Yeah.
A few with some creative shapes and forms.
Yeah, you probably don't see them much in most setups because I suppose they just get broken and that, but because we're small and we do everything by hand, things like that, we can do things like that. We've got a bit more flexibility than a system that's locked into set sizes.
So after 5 years in the pasture-raised egg business, does Phil Glover think they made the right move to go from cows to chooks? On the whole, it seems to have been an excellent business decision. Now, dairy farmers love being around their cows. How do you feel about your flock of Highland Brown hens?
It's pretty interesting. I don't think chooks probably engender that same, the same as a cow.
But they've got a little bit of personality.
Oh, they have, yeah. I think they probably, like with cows, you can see more individual differences, where the chooks, they tend to all pretty much look the same.
Dairy farmer turned egg producer Phil Glover swapping one 52 weeks a year job for another. You're with A Country Breakfast on RN. Still to come today, it's a mushroom-led recovery for a disability support group in Castlemaine in Victoria, and bees are keeping a family's dreams alive in tropical North Queensland.
And it's just learning to read the bees, so they'll tell you if they're agitated or...
You're not a farmer, but you have a few hectares of land to play with on your days off. What should you do? Plant some veggies? Grow some fruit trees? Perhaps turn your hand to running a few head of cattle? Well, the Cannon family from Mackay in tropical North Queensland considered all of these options before going in a completely different direction, turning their hand to beekeeping on their small rural block.
So the smoke disguises their alarm or attack pheromone.
Hello, I'm Lara Webster. It's hard to believe, but this sweet dream of producing and selling raw honey almost didn't happen. Doug had settled on growing fruit trees before his wife Janine had a last minute change of heart, sending them on their beekeeping journey.
We decided on lychees and I was ready to sort of put an order in to start off with 250 trees and get things happening and look at getting everything, all the work's done out on the farm. And then right at the last minute, Janine said, I don't want to do lychees. And I said, well, what do you want to do? And she says, well, what about bees? Which she has severe reactions to bees, yeah. So I was surprised that she went with bees.
The first bees arrived 6 years ago. The plan was to have just a couple of hives and leave the bees to it. But once again, the Kennans had a change of heart. Doug started researching bees and beekeeping, and his passion grew.
We went from two, and then we went to three, four, five. we just got to the point where they really consumed our lives, and we started looking more seriously at getting the numbers up of the colonies. And then we sort of made a decision a few years ago that it's something that we'd like to do as a family, as a lifestyle, and that's sort of where we started driving now all our time and efforts towards where we are today. So it's been a bit of a gradual process, but we're up to about 40 colonies now and looking to expand more. We're just sort of really trying to get the bees that we have where we want them to be health-wise, and looking to build up more numbers this coming season.
After a few years of trial and error, the couple are finally extracting and selling their raw honey on the local market. Demand is growing, but it's a time-consuming process getting their honey bottled.
So we focus on producing raw, unheated, untreated, unfiltered honey. So what that sort of means is basically just having honey as it used to be had. Basically, we just take it out of the comb, run it through a strainer, quite a coarse strainer, so it just takes out body parts and foreign objects, but still it allows the pollen to go through.
I guess it's a longer process. However, we've committed to it, and I guess as a commercial beekeeper, it's financially not the best option with the option of having pumps and equipment that can easily extract your honey. But yeah, we've made a commitment to delivering raw honey.
The Kennans have big dreams and hope one day to live off the income from the hives. They're now producing raw honey and turmeric and chili flavoured honeys, and have plans to branch out into the world of medicinal honeys too.
The main reason we've chosen this location, one, because it was gifted to us to an extent, but it just so happened to be, it's a really good place for bees. They've got the broadleaf Melaleuca, or Melaleuca vividiflora, and that is a really good nectar source for the bees. It's currently being looked at too for its medicinal qualities. Like Manuka honey, it has potential of being a real key honey for the medical practices.
But the bees represent much more than just an income to the Kennans. They represent the future the family wants. Doug Kennan currently works away from home in the coal mines, but he's hoping one day to be home every night with his wife and young daughter.
Janine, do you mind bringing that queen excluder up from? We don't have a desire to be millionaires, we're just trying to create a lifestyle more that we can be together. That's like I was saying before about meeting with farmers. That's one thing that really drew me to agriculture, is that family bond and unity. Yeah, just being together, really.
Yes, it's a family unit. Having Doug home every night, that would be really lovely. And having a job where you can be outside and, you know, be with the fresh air and with the bees, it's, yeah.
Don't go too far down in the depths of the container, do
you? Okay, if you guys want to start.
You could call it a mushroom-led recovery for this group of supported workers in Castlemaine in central Victoria. Inside this climate-controlled 40-foot shipping container, they're growing organic oyster mushrooms for local cafes and restaurants. Hello, I'm Larissa Romansky. It's a new business venture for the Windaring organisation, which supports people with disabilities. Last year they had to close their photocopying business, leaving some of their clients without meaningful work to do. For Pathways manager Mark Castle, the mushroom business ticks all the right boxes.
So with the mushroom business, we're finding that they can be engaged in all aspects, the customer-focused component, the growing, the harvesting. It's got a much more direct impact for them.
Team leader Mandy Fennessy agrees. She's been working at Windarring for the past 15 years.
It seems to be going really well. We go to the container every morning when we all arrive and we inspect how they're going and we pick them if we need to and then we put them into trays and we bring them back here and we weigh them and then we work out where we're going to go for the day and look at what customers that we're going to supply to. So we might have supplied to one on Friday, so we realise they don't need them, so on the Monday we'll find someone else.
Daisy Harrison is one of the staff who previously worked in the photocopy centre. While she admits it's very different work, she likes her new job.
It's interesting to see all the community, everyone around in the community, and meeting owners.
The idea for the urban mushroom farm came about after Windarring CEO Chris O'Connor watched an episode of Landline. It featured Western Australian mushroom company Lifecycle growing mushrooms from ground coffee waste. The company founders were staggered that only 1% of the ground coffee beans that are used to make a cup of coffee actually go into the final product. The rest usually winds up in landfill. In Melbourne alone, there is about 5,000 tonnes of coffee waste produced each week. Mark Castle said they are attracted to the project not only for its sustainability, but also the relative simplicity.
The oyster mushrooms are really forgiving in the growing process, so they grow so quickly. They grow within 7 to 10 days.
Whilst at the moment Windarring buy a prepackaged product from Lifecycle, which consists of a bag full of coffee grounds packed with mycelium, in the future they hope to expand the business.
We hope to collect coffee grounds from local cafes and will you then utilise that as a growing medium?
Mandy Fennessy says the supported staff are enjoying the work and learning valuable new skills along the way as they grow, pick, clean and sell the oyster mushrooms to local businesses.
There's always mathematics in everything that you do. So in the weighing of the mushrooms, they have to work out how many grams there are or how many kilos. So what we do, we come back here and they've got a little chart that they look at and they can refer to. We write down all the amounts and they get their calculators out through their phones, the only time they're allowed to use their mobile phones, and they use the calculator on the phone so that they can add up and work out how much produce we've got for that day.
At present, the Windarring facility is supplying about 10 customers with 1 or 2 kilograms of mushrooms a week. There's a lot of room for growth for the business. As Mark Castle says, they can produce up to 100 kilograms a week when in full production.
Obviously, there's a capacity we will reach, but we see the opportunities in Bendigo and Kyneton and all of those surrounding towns. We've got lots of cafes, lots of restaurants. So the opportunities are endless for us, really. But at the end of the day, it's about having engaging employment and a successful business that's going to sustain itself. So there's no point having a great business without providing engaging work opportunities for the guys that are involved in the business.
And while the mushrooms are easy to grow and a good way to deal with coffee waste, they also taste good, according to Daisy Harrison.
On the weekend, I had the oyster mushrooms with spring onion and they were lovely to have.
And that's Daisy Harrison, one of 4 supported staff members growing oyster mushrooms for the Windarring organisation at Castlemaine in central Victoria. Larissa Romanski with that story.